Woods, an infielder, William Joyner. And Woods is in the front there, and Bob Foots is standing on the left, and William Joyner is sort of in the middle there. The 1901 Ecos featured two of the best pitchers in the world, George Wilson, middle row, top row middle, and Billy Holland, sitting in the row in the bottom there. And they won the Minnesota State title, defeating the Kansas City Blues, champions of the Western League, 6-1. Wilson was a material fastball pitcher, threw several no-hitters in his career, and was also a powerful slugger, who usually batted cleanup. In 1903, Wilson joined the St. Cloud Minnesota Club and won 21 of his 29 decisions. Despite pitching with a sore arm, Wilson struck out a reported 251 batters in 227 innings, while allowing only about 1.59 runs per game on average. He fanned 10 or more batters in a game 10 times, while also tossing 11 shutouts, 6 two-hitters, 3 one-hitters, and 1 no-hitter. Alternating between center field and first base when he didn't pitch, Wilson spearheaded the St. Cloud attack by batting 395, 10 triples, 5 home runs, 41 scored in 41 games. So he's quite a ball player. In 1904, Renville banker Henry Stabenow is the guy that had there signed 5 extra unions in the Iowa Romneys for his Western Minnesota ball club. And it's far Western Minnesota, including Doggy Woods, Bert Jones, and Billy Holland. So you got to imagine, some of the best ball players in the world are playing in Minnesota, which didn't get their first street light until that year, I think. In 1905, in addition to George Wilson, the pitcher George Van Johnson, the All-Stars dominated the upper Midwest, losing only 11 out of 75 games played. The 1905 Chicago Union Giants were one of the top 5 black teams in the country, along with Vancouver City rivals, the Leland Giants. In October, the two clubs battled to a draw in a 4-game series. 9 out of the 10 players up here went on to play for the St. Paul Gophers or Minneapolis Key Centers. And much to my wife's chagrin, I can name all 10 of those guys. So. the St. Paul Gophers were formed in early 1907 by saloon owner Phil Daddy Reed, one of the Northwest's most influential and wealthy old African Americans. Securing many players for the release when Rube Foxer took over the Leland Giants, the Gophers competed against the best town teams and semi-pro clubs in Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas, winning a reported 92 games, only 15 losses, and 2 ties. Led by pitchers Clarence Tuglia, Johnny Davis, and catcher Jesse Schaefer, the Gophers won 36 straight games at one point, and in mid-September defeated the St. Paul Saints in the American Association, 2-1, with 1 tie to capture the official state championship. Reed imported his good friend Rube Foxer from Chicago to pitch in the deciding game, and the future Hall of Famer allowed only 5 hits and struck out 10 Saint batters as the Gophers won 5-3. Well, if you know anything about Minneapolis and St. Paul, you know they have a rivalry. So it came as no surprise when in March 1908, a young flamboyant Minneapolis borrower named David Kidd Mitchell reorganized a semi-pro outfit called the Keystones into a professional club whose intended goal was to be better than the Gophers to beat them. With the help of Secretary Eddie Davis and some big financial backing, 7 first-class players were acquired, mostly from Chicago Union Giants, within 2 weeks of the season inception. And here's the Keystone Hotel from Washington Avenue, 1313, Washington Avenue. Kid Mitchell was a member of the Knights of the Hits Patrol Group and ascended to the uniform rank of colonel. He also wore a great deal of personal jewelry, marking his fashion. The Annual Star, reading my newspaper today, marked to say that Kid Mitchell wears some diamonds. He certainly is worth talking about. Mitchell was quick-tempered, tight-fisted, and litigious. Under his direction, Keystones would cancel dates for refuse to play the financial terms are not to their liking. In at least 2 instances, the Kid instigated lawsuits over alleged breach of contract. In 1908, Mitchell's Keystones started a melee in Superior, Wisconsin, when they brandished a few guns in attempts to outdo their opponents. A year later, the Kid had forced to go to one of Minnesota for pointing a gun on the father of a Waterville player. While the Gophers dealt with conflict via diplomacy, the Keystones preferred intimidation. The Keystone saga is filled with incidents of umpire baiting, arguments with opposing teams, physical roughhousing, bean balls, as well as out and cheat. Yeah. I mean, they're professionals. And they're, you know, they're playing what's called 60-40. So if you won, you got 60% of the game. If you lost, you got 40%. They did not want to lose. Okay, they wanted the 60%. So the Keystones were a remarkable fine bunch of players made up of stars. It was not disputed. It was not acknowledged that they could be the teams of the American Association on equal terms. Unfortunately, their on-the-field behavior and a lot of fan criticism, none of them had a reputation as an aggregation of consent. They're in Atlantic, South Dakota in 1908. Walter Ball, pitcher for the St. Paul Gophers, and also for the Keystones. Raised in St. Paul, Walter Ball pitched for many white Midwestern teams before joining the Chicago Union Giants in 1903. Ball helped organize the St. Paul Gophers in 1907 until returning to Chicago to start for the Union Giants. By 1908, Ball was considered one of the best black players in America, aside from bluff pitching. He would tell the opposing hitter he was going to hit him, and then he'd throw that in the middle, basically. This is with best comments. Ball won several games for the Keystones until leaving the team early June for reasons that he refused to give out in question. George Hopkins, center fielder for the Keystones, and also one game for the Gophers. George Hopkins, whose big time black ball career began in 1886 with the New Orleans Unions, was originally a dominating pitcher who regularly served out 12 to 15 men a game, which was proclaimed by his contemporary Sol White to be the star of the West. After 1894, the strong Dave Hopkins made a transition to second base and then outfield for teams such as the Patriots, Giants, Algona Brownies, and Union Giants. In 1909, he was 51 years old in 1909, when he hit over 3.5 for the Keystones. Alex Happy Irwin, shortstop for the Mets, Keystones, and also for the Gophers. Alex Irwin was described as one of the best infielders ever seen in the Northwest Independent ranks, the top of every time he played. The original Keystone captain said to be even smaller 5'6", 138-pound Andy Boiler from the Yankees Phillips. An entertainer as well, the whirlwind shortstop from Davison, Illinois, and was at one point that he's opening a dancing academy in the Alps. Topeka Jack Johnson, first baseman and second baseman for the Keystones in 1908. Topeka Jack Johnson was a 6'2", 110-pound infielder, a sparring partner of heavyweight champion Jack Johnson. Topeka Jack played ball in a good style. This one's called the best black batter in the world. His swift fielding is said to be above criticism. He possessed tremendous range. During a boxing career that stretched in the late 1920s, Topeka Jack fought with the leading fighters, including Hall of Famers Jack Johnson, George Drillaget, and Samuel Meeker, whom he battled to a 10-round draw in 1921. One night in April 1906, Johnson defeated Irish baller Jim McCormick in a 9-round bout before leading the Topeka Giants to a 6-4 victory over Iowa at the Kansas State League the following afternoon. Topeka Jack did not exhibit any ill effects from his match, and this is a quote from the paper, save for a little stiffness in his throat, caused perhaps by McCormick, who followed him by biting a mouthful out of the shoulder. William Minga, third baseman and right fielder for the Keystones and also for the Gophers. Minga has season bet over 20 black ball campaigns. He's a professional hitter who is still racking up multiple hit games well into his 40s. His range in the field was limited, but never forgot an opposing batter or how hard he liked to hit. During two consecutive games in July of 1908, Minga cleanly handled 18 chances at third base. Bobby Marshall. First base with the Keystones, and then for the Gophers, 1907 through 11. Although born in Milwaukee, Bobby Marshall grew up in Twin Cities. And won 7 letters for football, baseball, and track at the University of Minnesota from 1903 to 2007. His greater accomplishments were so spectacular that he was named the College Football Hall of Fame in 1971. Mitchell, or Marshall, who failed to try out the Gophers in 1907, before sticking with the Keystones in 1908, spent the next 20 years playing professional baseball and football. He also became the first first black NFL player in history. So it's a tribute question. That's who he is. He's also a good base fielder with some pop in his bat and a long reach at first. When Walter Ball left the Keystones, Marshall took his place in the rotation with 8 out of 9 starts, allowing about 3.29 runs per game on average. Jesse Chapin, catcher and fielder for the Gophers and for the Keystones. Jesse Chapin was a firehider in the band, built not unlike former Minnesota's been great for Rebecca. At the plate, he was a powerful slugger, and the field, he was a terrible base fielder. Schaefer hit 320 for the Gophers in 1897 and 295 of the Keystones in 1908. The Keystones work by pitchers Charles Jessup, Charles Slip Jackson, and left fielder Eugene Cherry Martin for to the upper Midwest in 1908, on their way to an 88-19-2 record. During a July game to Decorah, Iowa, the Keystones were up so big in the eighth inning that Kid Mitchell, Curtis Wolfe paper, had the infielders and outfielders off the mat. Charles Jessup faced the last six batters and struck them all out, which probably irritated the people in Decorah, Iowa. In late July, Mitchell accused the Gophers of abducting his club, and after much posturing and haggling, the two teams agreed to meet in a five-game showdown series for 500 home site, which would be about $10,000 today. The Gophers behind Eagle Gate went to the August 27th opener in St. Paul, but the Keystones comes back a few days later and counts the St. Paul Club magnitude for 4,000 people at the Nehawk Rugby Park in Minneapolis. Charles Jackson put the Gophers hits for the first 6 innings, and the Keystones blasted 12 hits off the gateway, including a home run by Eugene Martin. When the teams met again 3 weeks later at Minnehaha, Jackson and Dean Lytle moved to a 3-3 tie for 8.5 minutes. Lytle retired Alex Irwin to be in the bottom of the ninth before Jackson reached an error by Gopher shortstop Frank Davis. Bill Bing had followed with a terrific fly from the Tallgrass. RBI on the Gopher did control fingers, which scored Jackson with a winning run in 4-3 Keystone's victory. The Gophers rebounded to take the last 2 games in the series, however, with Lytle, Bessie Jackson 6-0 at Nicollet Park in Minneapolis. This is Nicollet, I think, in the 40s or 50s, but in 1909, the competition increased between two clubs, and Willis Jones, Frank Davis, and Haywood Rose of the Gophers went over and joined the Keystones, and Bill Bing and Bobby Marshall of the Keystones went over and joined the Gophers. The Keystones enjoyed another funny campaign, losing only about 2,700, approximately 115 ball games, but they couldn't beat the Gophers, who down on four separate games. Willis Jones, outfielder for the Gophers, was 7-8, and the Keystones 19-9. Willis Jones was a fleet-footed base runner in left field with a rib full of ginger, known for keeping the spectators in good humor with his antics. If a ball game was lacking entertainment value, Jones would often give up vocal exhibitions, which cheered the fans on. Here's Willis Jones in 1908, when he stole 48 bases before the 1st of August. Haywood, kissing Bub Rose. First baseman for the Gophers, 1908-09, Keystones, 1909. Rose's colorful nickname is possibly based on his ability to eat him up at first. Kissing bugs are a rather dancing species of insect that transforms from being as flat as a wafer to a gold cup form while feeding on them. So, hopefully that's where I get some point. Haywood Rose for the Gophers, 1908. He was once conferred favorably to the Cubs' great Frank Munch Davis, shortstop for the Gophers in 1908, 7-8, the Keystones 1909-11. Shortstop Frank Davis was a great fielder in a brown car. He hurt his ankle in 1910, which reported that the Keystones fans nearly cried. Davis captained the Moose at his club in 1909 and batted over 306. During an August 1909 game in Mankato, Keystone pitcher Andrew Campbell was ejected by the local firefighter for using abusive language while coaching at third base. Bunch Davis told him to return to the box, saying that he would show the umpire that anyone could stay on the line for all of him. The Keystones were leading 9-5 at the time, ended up forfeiting the game when the squad's behavior was wrongly criticized in the city press. Kid Mitchell complained to the Minneapolis Tribune that the club was gotten together at great expense and they were entitled to better treatment. A few weeks earlier, Eugene Martin had led off this game in Waukegan, Iowa by sticking his tongue out with pitcher Peanuts Fielding and making faces until Peanuts hit him in the head. Peanuts would go on to hit Martin again during the Keystone's 42 victory. Many black ball stars got to start with the Keystones. In June 1909, William Dizzy Dismukes was signed by Kid Mitchell, but he pitched ineffectually and was quickly released. Dismukes went on to become an ace for the Minneapolis ABCs, as well as a manager and officer for many black ball teams, and during his remarkable 47-year career. In May 1911, Dismukes joined the West Bay Indiana Strudels, got some innovative revenge when he allowed only 5 hits for the Keystones 13-1. Later that year, the Lanky Submariner pitched the Strudels to a 2-1 victory over the Pittsburgh Pirates. who just won the World Series the year before. In 1910, Kid Mitchell jettisoned most of his previous year's team and sent several new players, including in-house ABC standouts John Big Boy Moriah, Frank Young, and left fielder David Shaw, front row seat, third from left, who said they'd be able to knock out home runs whenever the fans asked for one. However, the Keystone's on-the-field antics were costing the bookies, and the club abandoned the Midwest in May to represent San Antonio, Texas. A Twin Cities Black paper commented that a good team, a good players, and a good manager can secure good days, and this can only be done if they win with a clean ball. That rough-house business can't last long. It hurts everybody. But wherever Kid Mitchell went, controversy followed. In May, he sued Kansas City, Kansas Giants owner Toby Smith in a dispute over guarantee money. Mitchell called Smith the most unreliable man ever did business with, while the Giants owner accused Mitchell of making false and defamatory statements about him that were wholly devoid of everything which would enable his readers to know anything concerning their misunderstanding. So I think they're both lawyers. Big Bill Gaylord, pitcher for the Gophers, 1908 for the Keystones. Big Bill Gaylord joined the Keystones in late August 1909 and was appointed their captain for the 1910 campaign. Gaylord was a volatile, hard-living, 6'7", 240-pound fireball who later tossed the first ever no-hitter in the Negro National League. Said to possess a fastball as good as any pitcher who wears a toe clip, Gaylord threw so hard that even his catcher couldn't see much of it, except the jar of his arms when the ball hit his mitt. The St. Paul Dispatch marked no pitcher on his parts contention. Big Bill went on to mentor Satchel Paige, who did a cool Papa Bell's name. Clarence Du Lyle, pitcher outfielder for the Gophers, and for the Keystones in 1910. In 1910, Lyle, along with Gaylord, Charles Jackson, and newcomer Herman McNair, composed perhaps the best pitching staff in Mitchell's finest club. Although overall season records of note, Keystone reportedly defeated the Minneapolis Millers in an exhibition game, swept the Gophers in a series, and beat such top flight black giants as the Chicago Giants, St. Louis Giants, and Indianapolis ABC. Before the 1911 season began, Mitchell raided the Louisville Club Cubs, where uniform fielder Bert Woods, Jesse Briscoe, first baseman Louis Cap Embry. The Keystone started their campaign in the South against black clubs and minor league teams before cutting more and spending playing slightly better than 500 ball against small town nines in Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas. And I don't think they designed this poster. Archie Pate, which usually made the Dover 99. Keystones. Archie Pate was a suffering spitball pitcher who was on hand in Fayette, Iowa in 1911 when the Keystone players were arrested on charges of catching a fish so small that it barely was visible to the naked eye. This may be apocryphal, but the Keystone player requested that he be able to change into his clothes and come back. They said okay, the whole team came back, and according to Fayette reporter, because the authorities could not tell the difference, players, he was released. So, that made a tall table. Early McNair, control fielder for Keystone's 1910, and for the Gophers, one game in 1910. In 1911, McNair won over 20 games for Keystone to hit over 350. Friedman noted that McNair showed some remarkable abilities in mature clubs. A Charles City, Iowa paper remarked that McNair has a club with a devout invocation and a limited nerve. A later teammate with the Kansas City Monarchs said that McNair had taken two strikes on Jesus Christ is basically the next pitch. late August 1911, the Keystones arrived in Minneapolis, and they lost the first game of a four-game set. The wife of the owner told them that they didn't play better, she wouldn't take it back home in Minneapolis. So, led by Jesse Briscoe, had 5 hits in the last 2 games, and the salvage was split of the series. That winter, Kid Mitchell was hurt in a car accident, and the next spring, he decided to bring the Keystones back. The Gophers also folded that year, probably because of player wage, high travel costs, and the lack of substantial fan base in Twin Cities. In 1921, the Keystones were briefly revived in the Bobby Marshall, third from my background, by a club called the Aspen Ruby Red Sox, but after Kid Mitchell's death in the flu epidemic in 1919, a big time black baseball club never came back to Minnesota. The there were many great players who left there to play, like John Donaldson and Lester McDonald and Dave Brown. But Keystones and Vocals were left at the top flight players. During the meteoric fire resistance, the Nets Keystones posted a winning percentage well over 650. They were one of the first really natural black ball teams playing ball from Tennessee to Montana, and most points in between. Adopting the tone set by Kidman, the Keystones passed more than any other club of their era, anticipated the athlete of the 21st century. Independent, defiant, and proud to a fault. Not ready to damn anything that crosses past. Thank you.
Something maybe on 6'6", 4. I mean,
I'm wondering if the big came from just the
power,
the sturdy body. He was built kind of stocky. So I wonder if that. Yeah.